Beloved Boguan, Rinzai became known as the master of the shouts. On one occasion, a monk asked, "What about the cardinal principle of the Buddha Dharma?" Rinzai shouted. The monk bowed. "Do you say that's a good shout?" Rinzai asked. The monk commented, "The thief in the grass has met complete defeat." "What's my offense?" Rinzai asked. The monk replied, "It won't be pardoned a second time." Rinzai gave a shout.
Manisha, this silent and beautiful evening, we are going to start a new series of meditations on the sutras of Rinzai. Rinzai is one of the most loved masters in the tradition of Zen. His specialty consists in the first transmission of the light happened between Gautam Buddha and Mahakashyapa. The second great transmission happened between Bodhidharma and his successor. Bodhidharma took away from India the ultimate experience of consciousness to China. Rinzai introduced the same consciousness, the same path of entering into oneself from China to Japan. These three names, Mahakashyapa, Bodhidharma, and Rinzai, extend like great peaks of the Himalayas. One of the most difficult thing is to change an experience into explanation. And from one language to another language, it becomes almost an impossible task. But Bodhidharma managed. And Rinzai also managed. This transmission of the lamp has to be understood deeply. Only then you will be able to understand the sutras that follow. No language is capable to translate an inner experience, a subjective experience. For the simple reason, because the language is created for the objective world, about things, about people. No language has been created about the innermost center of your being. For the simple reason that when two men of the same experience meet, there is no need to say anything. Their very presence, their very silence, the depth of their eyes, and the grace of their gestures is enough. And there are only three situations. Either two enlightened beings meet, then the language is not needed. They both meet beyond language. Their meeting is the meeting of no mind. The second situation is two unenlightened people meet, in which they will talk much, they will use great words, much philosophy, much metaphysics, but it will be all meaningless. It will not be supported by their experience. They are just parrots repeating other people's words. Obviously, they cannot create the language for the Buddhas. They have no idea what it is in the innermost core of your being. The third possibility is a meeting between an enlightened person and an unenlightened person. The enlightened person knows, the unenlightened person does not know. But although the enlightened person knows, it is not enough to convey it. To know is one thing, to transfer it into language is another thing. You know what love is. You can sing a song, You can dance, but you cannot say a single word about what love is. You can have it. You can be overwhelmed by it. You know absolute experience of love, but still you cannot bring even a fragment of it into words. Words are not meant for it. And to transfer it from one language to another language is almost an impossibility. Even Buddha did not say anything to Mahakashyapa. Mahakashyapa simply lived with Buddha for many years, sitting silently under his tree. He never asked a question. He simply waited and waited and waited. The longer he waited, the more silent he became. The longer and deeper his patience, the greater became his trust and his love and his gratitude. Just by waiting, he was going through a metamorphosis. He was changing into a new man. Nobody would have known it if by chance this incident has not happened. A great philosopher of those days, Molong Kiputta, came to Buddha in India. In those days, that was very common tradition that teachers will go to other teachers to discuss matters. With great respect, they will fight tooth and nail, and whoever was defeated will become the disciple of the victorious. Molong Kiputta has defeated hundreds of teachers, and he had come to Gautam Buddha now with 500 followers to challenge him. This challenge was not antagonistic. This challenge was absolutely in search for truth. Molong Kiputta said with deep respectfulness, "I want to challenge you to have a debate with me Buddha said, there is no problem. But that will not decide anything. You have been discussing with hundreds of teachers and you have been victorious not because you have the truth, but because you are more logical, more argumentative, more sophisticated than the others. It does not mean that you have a truth. It simply means you are better educated. You have done your homework better than the other. You are clever, intelligent, and have a very sharper logical capacity, but that does not mean you have the truth. Do you want to inquire the truth or just to have a debate? Because these hundreds of debates, what has happened? You have gathered hundreds of followers and you don't have the truth yourself. Now you have taken responsibility of hundreds of followers. Do you understand what you are doing? Those days were of tremendous honesty. Malungputta said, you are right. I don't know as an experience what truth is. But I can argue about anything. I have been trained in argumentation. He was a sophist who can argue either for or against. It doesn't matter. Before Socrates in Greece, there was no philosophy but only sophistry. Teachers were roaming around teaching people how to argue. It does not matter for what. Whether you are right or wrong, that is irrelevant. What is relevant is whether you have a weightier argument than the other. Socrates changed the whole history of philosophy in the West. He said that this is absolutely stupid. Just being logically more proficient does not mean you have the truth. And somebody may have the truth, and it is more probable that the man who has the truth may not be able even to say it. The question of argumenting about it, for it, does not arise. He may not find even words to convey it. Buddha said to Malungputta that if you are really a man in search of truth, then sit down by my side. For 2 years, as if you are not. No questions, no communications. And after 2 years, I will remind you that the day has come. Now you can challenge me. At this moment, Mahakashyapa, who has been there for 30 years with Buddha, suddenly burst out laughing. The whole gathering of 10,000 monks could not believe this man has never spoken a word to anybody, not even to Buddha. He had never come even to touch his feet or to say hello. He remained sitting far away under his tree. He has monopolized the tree. Nobody could sit there. And what happened suddenly that he started laughing so loudly? Malankuputta said, "What is the matter?" Buddha said, "You can ask him yourself." Mahakashyapa said, "The matter is simple. This man, Gautam Buddha, is cheating you. He cheated me. He has told me also to remain silent for 2 years. Now 30 years have passed. And the question does not arise. My silence has deepened. Now I know who am I. I know the very height of my consciousness. Not that I have found any answer. There is no question and no answer. Just a pure, clear silence. So if you want to ask him, we will all enjoy. You can ask, but this is the time to ask. Don't wait for 2 years. That's why I laughed. Again he is back to his tricks. There are many here who had come with the same desire, Sariputra and Moggallan and other great philosophers of that time had come with the same desire to discuss, but this barrier of 2 years silence is very dangerous. If you want to ask anything now, right now, is the time. That's why I laughed. Malankuputta has brought a beautiful lotus flower as a gift for Gautam Buddha. He called Mahakashyapa and gave the lotus flower to him. This is called in the Zen tradition the first transmission. Nothing has been said, but everything has been heard. His silence and the childlike laughter is enough to prove he has found it. And the giving of the lotus flower to Mahakashyapa is a certificate. Mahakashyapa this way becomes the first patriarch of Zen tradition.
After him, there have been 6 others, master to disciple, again and again in silence, the flame has been transferred. The 6th one was a woman, and Bodhidharma was her disciple. Those were the golden days when a woman, particularly in the East, was not thought to be inferior to men. She could become the master. She transferred her understanding to Bodhidharma and told him that your work is to pass the Himalayas and go to China. It is a difficult task. First, to go by feet across the Himalayas. It took 3 years for poor Bodhidharma to reach China. And then the greatest barrier was, he knew nothing of Chinese. It is difficult, even if you knew the Chinese, but he managed. He surrounded slowly, slowly by people who were really thirsty. And all that was happening was that he will sit silently facing the wall for 9 years continuously. And those who wanted to sit, they will come and sit around him. Just sitting around him, without any language, without any communication, some energy started moving. Something started happening to people. Their life styles changed. Their life became a grace and a beauty. After 14 years, Bodhidharma left China back to disappear into the Himalayas. He was too old now. And you cannot find a better place to disappear than the Himalayas. Utter silence. Eternal snows, which have never melted, thousands of places where nobody has ever reached. Before leaving, he called 4 of his disciples and told them that I am leaving. My time has come. This body cannot contain me anymore. Soon my consciousness will open its wings and will be gone. Before it happens, I want to reach to the Himalayas. And I have called you four. One of you is going to be my successor. So this is a great test. I am asking the same question to four. It will depend on your answer, who is my successor? He asked, what is the essence of my coming from India to China? The first man said, you have come to spread the great experience of Gautam Buddha. Bodhidharma said, you are right, but not much. You are just my skin. Sit down. He looked to the other disciple. He said, your coming to China means bringing the very revolution in the innermost being from unconsciousness to consciousness. He said, a little better, but still not satisfactory. Sit down. And he looked at the third disciple, and the third disciple said, you have come to spread that which cannot be said. Bodhidharma said, you are far better than the other two, but even this much, that nothing can be said about it, you have said something. Just sit down. The first one has my skin, the second one has my bones. You have my flesh. And he looked at the fourth one, who had only tears of gratitude and joy, and just collapsed into the feet of Bodhidharma without saying a word. Bodhidharma told him, you have my very marrow. You are my chosen disciple. What others could not say with their words, you have said with your tears. What others could not say with great significant statements, you have stated by your gratitude. Rinzai comes after a few more patriarchs. And just as Bodhidharma was sent by his master, Rinzai's master sent him to Japan. It was again the same difficult task. But as Mahakashyap succeeded, Bodhidharma succeeded, Rinzai also succeeded. In creating silence, in turning people inwards, the message is not linguistic. The message is existential. The master can only create a certain situation, a certain device, in which if you allow, if you are receptive, you can be transformed. This transformation is almost a death and a resurrection. Your old personality will fade away. Your original face will show. The face that you are carrying right now is given by the society to you, by the culture, by the education, by the parents. Your personality is not your originality. Your originality has been covered with all kinds of lies. Convenient to the society and the vested interests. Being with a master, your personality is going to drop out just as dead leaves drop out. You will remain utterly naked as you were born. All knowledge that you have borrowed will disappear. You will be as innocent as a child. In this innocence, there is no need to say anything. That's what happened to Molunkuputta. After 2 years, he completely forgot about the time. Those 2 years were of such silence that few days he counted, then he dropped the idea of counting. Few days, thoughts passed through his mind, but how long they can, if you are not interested in them, if you are just a mirror, they come like clouds and go away without leaving any trace behind. In 2 years' time, he was pure innocence. No question, no answer, no debate, no challenge. Those were all part of the personality that has melted down in 2 years. Living in the energy field of a Buddha, Buddha himself told Molunkuputta that, have you forgotten? Today, 2 years are complete. Now, if you want to challenge me, If you want to ask any question and discuss anything, I am ready. Molungputta touched Buddha's feet and said, Mahakashyapa was right. I am no more. Who is there to challenge you? I am no more. Who is going to ask the question? And who is going to listen to the answer? These 2 years pass so soon. It seems as if just the other day I had come here. You have done a miracle. Buddha said, I have not done anything. Just being in my presence, slowly, your heart starts a kind of synchronicity with the Master's heart. By and by you melt down in the warmth and love of the Master. This has been my experience, that at least 2 years is a necessary time to complete the process. Forgive me for keeping you waiting for 2 years. But there is no other way of reaching from heart to heart, from being to being. Rinzai did the same miracle in Japan, and his credit is tremendous, because in Japan Zen reached to the highest peak. The seed was born in India, in Gautam Buddha. It was carried as a flower by Mahakashyapa for 6 generations. Bodhidharma is the 7th who carried it as a full-blown flower to China. Even the emperor has come to receive him. His fame has reached before him. But the emperor could not understand the ways of Zen. It has a certain way, a certain approach, which is not available to any other religious tradition. It is unique, a category in itself. Who has come from long, from his capital to the border of China to receive Bodhidharma, and what he saw, he was shocked. Because Bodhidharma was carrying one shoe on his head and one shoe on his feet. Now the emperor was a very sophisticated man. He had a great court of very cultured people. This kind of behavior, but just because of his sophistication and culture, he could not say anything about it. He is not even yet introduced. He avoided to see the shoe sitting on the head. And he asked, because he was the man who has made thousands of Buddha statues in China, has brought 1,000 scholars from India to translate in combination with Chinese scholars all the Buddhist scriptures into China. He has done much and converted the whole country into a land of Buddha. Obviously, the monks used to say to him that you have accumulated too much virtue. All these virtuous acts, immense is going to be your reward in the other world. He asked Bodhidharma that I have done all these things, what is going to be my reward? Bodhidharma said, you idiot, you will fall directly into hell. You are asking for a reward. The very idea of reward is of greed. The very idea to achieve something is not a reflection of your wisdom. The emperor was sagged, his court was sagged. But how to get away now? This man is not right man to bring in the country. He still asked another question, did not took any note of the insulting language that Bodhidharma has used. He said, your holiness. And he could not complete his sentence. He said, Bodhidharma said, there is nothing holy, nothing unholy. All is empty, just pure nothingness. These divisions of the mind, the sacred and the profane, the holy and the unholy, the saint and the sinner, does not exist. As you enter into deeper meditations, all divisions disappear. So don't call me your holiness. I have left behind that kind of childish language of being holy, of being unholy. be straightforward. The king said, my mind continuously remains cluttered with thoughts. And I have been reading the Buddhist scriptures, and they all say, unless you are thoughtless and yet perfectly aware, you will not find the truth. Bodhidharma said unexpectedly, he was a very unexpected man. You could not have predicted his behavior. He said, if that is the problem, come early in the morning, I am not entering China. I am going to live outside in this small temple. You can come early in the morning, 3 o'clock, but come alone. No courtiers, no guards, no arms, just come alone. And I will put all your thoughts aside from your mind. I will bring the silence to your mind. The emperor was very much afraid. This man seems to be almost insane. The whole night he could not sleep. Was hanging between the idea whether to go or not to go, alone. And that man is so mad, keeping one shoe on his head, calling me idiot, and he has a big staff, and he has told me not to bring any arms. He can do anything. He may hit, he may throw a rock. He thought all kinds of things, but by the time of going, a great pull, he felt that whatever he said, however he behaved, but he has a tremendous presence and a great magnetic pull. I will risk. He went to the temple. Bodhidharma was waiting for him. And Bodhidharma said, it is a very simple matter. You just sit here, and I am sitting in front of you, and you see my staff. If I feel that some thought is stubborn and is not leaving you, I will hit your head. And your work is only to watch your thoughts without any judgment. Just be a witness. The emperor thought, perhaps I have taken a wrong step. This man can hit any moment because my mind is full of thoughts. But let us try, now that I have come, it will look very cowardly to go away. So he said before Bodhidharma, just watching it, thoughts. The watching of the thoughts implies no judgment, no appreciation, no identification. Just watch as you watch the crowd passing through the road, or you watch the clouds moving in the sky with no judgment. Your mind is only a screen. Few clouds are moving. You simply watch. You are the watcher. And everything else in the world is the watched. As the morning sun was rising, the whole aura of the emperor changed. Just within 2 hours, there was no thought left. Witnessing is such a fire, the only fire that can bring you to your truth, that can burn all your falsity, all your phoniness. Bodhidharma saw the changing face. A new grace arising. He shook the emperor and told him, "Is there any thought anymore?" The emperor fell into his feet and told him, "You certainly did. I pray to you, don't leave China. All those scholars and monks and priests are simply parrots. They go on talking about witnessing and watching, but you have given me the experience. Without teaching me about witnessing, you have simply made me a witness. I don't need anything anymore." The moment you find your witness, you have found your ultimate eternal being. That is your purest consciousness. That makes you a Buddha. And it is everybody's potentiality. Rinzai managed to transform the whole fabric of the Japanese consciousness. And he did more than anybody else. He brought new dimensions into meditation. Unbelievable, but everything he transformed into meditation. Archery. Now, nobody can think archery can be a meditative act. But Rinzai managed and maintained that every act, if you do with full awareness, just as a witness, not as a doer. Becomes meditation. A little note about Rinzai, master of the irrational. Rinzai, also known as Linchi, was born in the early 9th century and was to become the founder of one of the most significant schools of Zen. Brilliant as a child, later when Rinzai became a priest, he studied the sutras and scriptures, realizing the answer did not lie within them. He went on pilgrimage, visiting Obaku and Daigu, two great masters. After his enlightenment, he became priest of a small temple on the banks of the Huto River. Manisha has asked, beloved Bhagwan, Rinzai became known as the master of the sauts. He used sauts as a method to silence you. A sudden sout. You are asking about God, you are asking about heaven, you are asking about great philosophical or theological problems, and the master immediately shouts. Your mind gets a shock, almost an electric shock. For a moment, you are not, only the sound. For a moment, the mind stops, the time stops. And that is the whole secret of meditation. Many mystics around the world have used sounds but in a very superficial way. Rinzai used sounds in a tremendously deeper way. His sounds will get just like a sword entering in you, piercing to the very center. You can understand when you shout Yahoo, your mind disappears. Yahoo has no meaning. But shouting it you get suddenly thrown to your own center. And once you have touched your own center, even for a simple glimpse, your life has started changing. Rinzai will shout at the disciples to give them a first experience of their centering. You are both a circumference and a center. You live on the circumference. The shout simply pushes you to the center. And once being at the center, you suddenly see the whole world changing. Your eyes are no more the same. Your clarity and transparency is absolute. You see the same green leaves greener, the same roses rosier, the same life as a festival, as a ceremony. You would love to dance and then the disciples, once they have learned that the shout can help them to reach to their very center, it was a strange sight when he started accepting disciples near the river. That the disciples will be shouting around the whole valley, and the valley will resound with shouts. You could see from miles away that somewhere you are close to Rinzai. It was not only that he was shouting. Shouting was a method. To throw you from the circumference to the center. There are many ways to throw you to the center. Every way is valid if you reach to your center, because your center is the only immortal part in you. Everything is going to die. Today, Professor Bach is here. He has done a tremendous job in translating Rumi. He has come as close as possible But I don't think he knows that Rumi's whole effort is by whirling to find the center. If you whirl for hours, you will see slowly that something at the very center is not moving at all. And that is you. Your body is whirling, but your consciousness is a pillar of light. Rumi attained his first enlightenment by whirling for 36 hours continuously. People thought he is mad. And even today, a small group of his followers continues . They are called whirling dervishes. But the point is the same. Whirling, your whole body becomes a cyclone. And your witnessing self becomes the center. Everything moves around you, but the center remains unmoving. And to know this unmoving center is to know the very master key of all the mysteries of life. Rinzai had no idea about Rumi. Neither Rumi has any idea about Rinzai. But both were working on the same strategy, somehow to force you to the center. As your consciousness becomes deeper, as it becomes an easy thing to go to the center, just as you go in your house and come out, you have become a Buddha. Then slowly, slowly your center starts changing your circumference. Then you cannot be violent. Then you cannot be destructive. Then you are love, not that you love. You are love. Then you are silence. Then you are truth. Although the old you has disappeared, that was your circumference. That was the cyclone that is gone. Only the center. Rinzai's method is far more simpler than Rumi's. Very few people will be able to whirl for hours. But shouting is a simpler method. Anybody can shout and can shout wholeheartedly. And it can be very intense and urgent. Whirling will take hours to find out the center. Shouting in a split second and you are at the center. Rinzai became known as the master of the shouts. On one occasion, a monk asked, "What about the cardinal principle of the Buddha Dharma?" Now he is asking something important. What is the cardinal principle of the religion of Buddha? Rinzai shouted. The monk bowed. "Do you say that's a good shout?" Rinzai asked. The monk commented, "The thief in the grass has met complete defeat." "What is my offense?" Rinzai asked. The monk replied, "It won't be pardoned a second time." Rinzai gave another shout. The anecdote the first shout of Rinzai was perfectly good. The monk has bowed down. Because he felt a great relief by moving from the circumference to the center. But Rinzai was a little suspicious. Because everything in this world becomes traditional. It has started becoming traditional. Rinzai will shout, and you have to bow down to show that you have understood it, that it has reached to your center. Because it was becoming a tradition, this is very unfortunate. Everything becomes a habit, a ritual, a tradition, and loses all meaning. Now his bowing down may be true or may be just a mannerism. That's why Rinzai asked, "Do you say that's a good shout?" The monk commented, "The thief in the grass has met complete defeat." What he is meaning by this? The monk is saying that you have been found being unsuccessful. Your shout missed. The monk commented, "The thief in the grass has met complete defeat." "What is my offense?" Rinchai asked. The monk replied, "It won't be pardoned a second time." The monk is saying that your shout missed. He is not saying that shouting at him second time will not be pardoned. He is saying that your being a failure will not be pardoned. It won't be pardoned a second time. First time, I forgive you. You missed. You did not reach to my center. I bowed down because you tried. You tried hard. But second time, it will not be pardoned. Anybody reading it will think that he is saying, if you shout second time, it will not be pardoned. That is not the case. He is saying your failure will not be pardoned second time. Rinzai gave a shout. And the anecdote ends suddenly. After the shout, there is silence. The second shout succeeded. Now the monk is silent. Rinzai is silent. There have been long processes of reaching to yourself, like yoga. But devices like Rinzai are very simple. Don't acquire any discipline as a prerequisite. Anybody no need of having a certain character, good or bad, sinner or saint. It does not matter. What matters is to reach to the center. Because at the center, neither you are a sinner nor a saint. Your being a sinner or a saint are all on the periphery. Our whole society lives on the periphery. Our all divisions are very superficial. I am reminded of a great follower of Buddha, Nagarjuna. He lived naked. Perhaps Nagarjuna is the greatest logician that has walked on the earth. Aristotle's are no comparison to him. Neither the Sankara. Nagarjuna's argumentation is the most refined, but he used to live naked. A beautiful man, and even kings and queens were disciples to him. In a certain capital, the queen was his disciple. She asked him that you will have to give me a favor. I want to take away your begging bowl. He said, that is not a problem, you can have it. She said, that is only the half part. I have prepared a begging bowl for you. So this one you give to me, it will be a present. The most precious to me in the whole world. And I have made a begging bowl. You cannot reject it. You have to accept it. He said, but I have not seen it either. She said, seeing or not seeing is not the question. First, give me the promise that you will not reject. So he said, okay, I will not reject. She brought out the bowl. It was made of solid gold, studded with diamonds. Nagarjuna said, you don't understand the situation. Whether I reject or not, I will not be able to keep it even for a few hours. A naked man carrying a begging bowl made of solid gold, studded with great diamonds. Do you think I will be able to keep it? But I have promised, so I will accept it. A thief was watching the whole transaction. He followed Nagarjuna. He knew that this fellow lives outside the city in a dilapidated temple. And every afternoon, after he has taken his food, he goes to sleep. This is very good time to take this begging bowl away. Anyway, somebody is going to take it away. So he went, and he was hiding behind a wall by the side of a window. watching that somebody else does not enter inside, Nagarjuna made his place to sleep, and he had complete awareness that somebody has been following. And why keep him unnecessarily waiting? Anyway, I am going to sleep and he will take the begging bowl. It is better to give him. Why make him a thief? So he threw the begging bowl outside the window where the thief was sitting. The thief could not believe. Really a strange man. And a strange desire arose in the thief that it will be good to have a little time to sit in his feet. So he asked from the window, "Can I come in?" Nagarjuna said, "What do you think I have thrown the begging bowl for? To bring you in. Come in." That was just an invitation. The thief could not understand, but was very much impressed by the man. He said, "I did not want to make you a thief. That's why I had thrown the begging bowl. Now you can have it." The thief said, "It is so precious. You are a man of great mastery over yourself. I also hope one day I will not be a thief but a master like you." Nagarjuna said, "Why postpone it? It is a very simple secret. You can become a master." He said, "You don't understand. I am a thief. I am a born thief. I cannot resist the temptation." Nagarjuna said, "It does not matter at all. You can remain a thief. I will give you a small meditation that whatever you do, even if you go to steal in the palace, just be a witness of what you are doing. I don't want you not to be a thief. Do it, whatever you want to do. But do it with full awareness. Just be a witness." He said, "This seems to be simple. I have been going to many saints. They say, first you drop stealing. Otherwise you cannot be religious. You are the first man who are not asking me to drop stealing." Nagarjuna said, "Those saints that you have met are not saints. No saint will ask you to drop stealing. Why? Do it perfectly well, just remain a witness." The thief could not understand the strategy. After third or fourth day, he came back to Nagarjuna and said, "You are very clever. In these 4 days there have been so many opportunities to steal, but as I go for stealing, taking something immediately, my hand relaxes. The moment I witness myself stealing, it seems to be so embarrassing that I pull my hand out. For 4 days I have not been able to steal anything." Nagarjuna said, "Now it is your problem. I have nothing to do with it. You can choose. You can choose witnessing, or you can choose stealing." The man said, "These 4 days only I have been able to feel my own dignity. I cannot drop witnessing. I am coming with you." What witnessing does is again throwing back to your center. At the center you are a Buddha. On the periphery, who you are does not matter. Once you start living at the center, slowly, slowly your circumference will start changing its colors. It will become as pure as you are at the center. It will become as compassionate as you are at the center. It will take all the fragrance of the center in all your activities. The authentic religion does not preach morality. Morality comes on its own accord. The authentic religion teaches you to be centered in yourself. Then everything that is good follows, and that is bad simply does not arise. It is not a question of choice. Choicelessly, you are good. It is not that you are being good. You cannot be otherwise. This is the miracle of Zen. Zen simply means witnessing. These shouts throw you to the center, and once you have learned to be at the center, you will know that on the periphery you are always a beggar, and on the center you are always an emperor. And who wants to be a beggar? Religion is the alchemy of transforming beggars into emperors. A great Zen poet, Ikkyu, wrote, "Crazy madman blowing up a crazy wind, wandering here and there, amidst brothels and wine shops, is there an enlightened monk who can match me? Even for a single word, I paint the south, I paint the north, I am painting the west and the east. He is saying that people think I am crazy. Crazy madman blowing up a crazy wind, wandering here and there amidst brothels and wine shops. An authentic Buddha is not afraid of brothels and wine shops. The saints who are afraid are really repressed people. They are not transformed beings. Is there an enlightened monk who can match me? A Buddha can move with absolute freedom in the marketplace. Those who renounce the world are the cowards, the escapists, and they have destroyed all the religions of the world. All the religions are in the hands of the cowards. An authentic religious man is a lion. And he is so centered in himself that he is not worried being anywhere. He is so certain of his purity, of his eternity, of his divinity, that he knows that if a thief comes to him, it is the thief who will have to change. If a prostitute comes to him, it is the prostitute that will have to change. Our so-called saints are so much afraid. Their fear shows their depressions. And a repressed man is not a religious man. He is simply sick. He needs psychiatric treatment. Manisha has asked, "Beloved Bhagwan, our love for music, poetry, dance, our love for love itself, does not that suggest an urge in us to disappear? If that is so, why does meditation, the art of disappearing, not come more naturally to us?" Manisha, music, poetry, dance, love, are only halfway. You disappear for a moment, then you are bare. And the moment is so small, just as a great dancer Nijinsky said, that when my dance comes to its crescendo, I am no more. Only dance is. But that happens only for a small fragment of time. Then again you are back. According to me, all these poetry, music, dance, love are poor substitutes for meditation. They are good, beautiful, but they are not meditation. And meditation does not come naturally to us, because in meditation you will have to disappear forever. There is no coming back. That creates fear. Meditation is a death. Death of all that you are now. Of course, there will be a resurrection, but that will be a totally new, fresh, original being of which you are not even aware, which is hidden in you. It happens in poetry, in music, in dance only for a small moment, that you slip out of your personality and touch your individuality. But only because it happens for a small moment, you are not afraid. You are always back in meditation. Once you are gone in, you are gone in. Then even when you resurrect, you are a totally different person. The old personality is nowhere to be found. You have to start your life again from ABC. You have to learn everything with fresh eyes, with a totally new heart. That's why meditation creates fear. The Upanishads say that the master is a death. It is incomplete sentence. The master is a death, but also a rebirth, a resurrection. And a master is nothing but meditation. A master simply gives you a meditation. He cannot do anything else. He gives you meditation to die and to be reborn. A meditator can play music. It will have a totally different significance. A meditator can write poetry. But then the poetry will not be only a composition of words. It will express something inexpressible. A meditator can do anything, but he will bring to it a new grace, a new beauty, a new significance. Music, poetry, dance, or love can become hindrances to meditation if you stop at them. First comes meditation, and then you can create great poetry and great music, but you will not be the creator. You will be just a hollow bamboo flute. The universe will sing songs through you, will dance dances through you. You will be only an address, care of you. Existence will express itself. You will be just a hollow bamboo. Meditation makes you a hollow bamboo. Then whatever happens through that hollowness, that empty heart, belongs to existence itself. Then existence sings songs. There are very few songs which existence for example, in the Bible, the Old Testament, the Song of Solomon is existential. It is very strange that Jews don't want even to mention the Song of Solomon. They are very much worried if somebody discovers the song. It is so beautiful, so authentic and true. But in this world of falseness, phoniness, hypocrisy, anything authentic is suspected. The Upanishads, the Book of Tao, or the Book of Mirdad, very few sculptures, old classical music, few pieces have descended from existence itself, and the musician has been just an instrument. He has allowed it through him to take shape, to take form. As far as I am concerned, poetry and music and love and dance are more religious activities than the so-called religious rituals, because at least they give you a little glimpse. If you follow that glimpse, you will enter into meditation. Meditation directly and naturally does not attract you, because of a great fear of death, and you don't know after death whether there is going to be a resurrection or not. That's the place where a master is needed to give you a promise, a trust, that don't be worried. That which is dying is not you, and that which is arising is your original being. But you can have a master only if you can trust someone. It is going into very dangerous ways. Meditation is the most dangerous thing. You need someone who has been on the path, who has been trodding on the path, coming and going. You need someone who can create courage, encouragement and trust in you that you can take the quantum leap. Now, it is Sardar Gurdayal Singh's time. One morning, Nancy Reagan is sorting out the laundry when she comes across one of Ronald's white shirts. It seems Ronnie's ballpoint pen broke and it spread a nasty red stain with a dark center on the chest pocket of the shirt. When Nancy gives the shirt to her Chinese laundryman Wang, he holds it up and looks at the stain for a couple of minutes, then shaking his head with approval, Wang says to Nancy, "Nice shirt." Ronald Reagan is brought to trial on a charge of molesting a female chimpanzee at the Washington Zoo. He is convicted quickly by a unanimous decision. Afterwards, old Judge Grump looks at Reagan and says, "Mr. President, sir, do you have anything to say to this court before I pass sentence on you?" "Your Honor," says the senile president, "only one thing. If I had known there would be such a fuss about all this, I would have married the bitch. Father Dingle goes to Jerusalem for a holiday to see all the holy relics. Out of curiosity, he goes to visit the famous Jewish shrine, the Wailing Wall. When he gets there, he watches in amazement as all the Jewish men pray wildly, waving their arms and with their whiskers whirling in the breeze. Suddenly he notices a man standing quite calmly, talking softly to the wall, without any wild gestures at all. It is strange because Jews cannot talk without waving their hands. Father Dingle goes over to the man and introduces himself. "Good afternoon. My name is Father Dingle," says the priest, "and I could not help noticing that your method of praying is different from everyone else around here." "Praying?" says Moise, the old Jew. "Who is praying?" "I am talking to God. I am asking for his advice." "Ah," says Father Dingle in surprise, "well, I don't want to be nosy, but what kind of advice?" "All types of advice," replies Moise, "like should I let my son go to Pune? Should I let my daughter marry her no good American boyfriend? How to persuade my wife Ruthie to be more adventurous in bed?" Things like that. "I see," says Father Dingle. "And what does the God tell you?" "Ha," says Moise, "tell me. I have been standing here for 30 years and he has told me nothing. It is like talking to a brick wall."
be silent. Close your eyes. Feel your body to be completely frozen. Now look inwards. Collecting your total consciousness with a great urgency, as if this is going to be your last moment, penetrate into the center of your being. The moment you reach at the center, you are a Buddha. Suddenly, thousands of flowers start showering on you. The whole universe starts rejoicing. At this moment, only consciousness is there. All divisions disappear. Just a witnessing, and slowly, the Buddha auditorium becomes a lake of consciousness. Not 10,000 Buddhas, but one Buddhahood. Just a lake without any ripples. This is your original face. The whole revolution of religion is to bring the Buddha from the center to the circumference. How blissful and how peaceful the moment has become. The evening was beautiful in itself. But the presence of 10,000 Buddhas has made it a majestic splendor. To make the witnessing more clear, Nivedano, relax, just watch. The body is not you, the mind is not you, you are only the witnessing. This experience of witnessing is the ultimate truth of your being.
This is what the Upanishads have called Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram. Truth, good, beauty. In this space you are eternal. You have never known any birth, you have never known any death. All that happens on the circumference. At the center there is no death, no birth. Just a pure sky. You are blessed. To be here, in this tremendously valuable moment, gather as many flowers and fragrances, persuade the Buddha to come along with you. Soon Nivedana will be calling you back. Before that, witness the path that you have gone through and you will be coming back through the same path. This acquaintance with the path that leads from the circumference to the center is of uttermost importance, because you will have to go again and again and again till your circumference and center become one. When Nivedana calls you back, remember that you are a Buddha. Come back with the same grace and the beauty and the joy and the blissfulness. Nivedana, come back. But come back as a Buddha, silently, peacefully, with a great grace. Sit down for a few moments, just to recollect and remember where you have been, what path you have followed, what you have experienced has to become part of your daily life. You have to express your Buddha in your actions, in your gestures, in your words, in your silences. Slowly, slowly. The old disappears and the new is born. This new man is the only hope for the whole world. We have to spread the message to every human being around the earth that you are the Buddha, just you have forgotten it. Remember, it is not something to be achieved, but only remembered. Hence, it is very easy and very obvious. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, Bhagwan.